It's Coast to Coast AM, and this is Ian Punnett. I am mindful of the awesome responsibility that is mine tonight, both with our first hour guest, Joyce Riley. It's been a while since we've had her on, and we will be following up on one of your suggestions last week, trying to find out what is the latest with Americans suffering from Gulf War syndrome. And find out coming up why our troops are returning home different than when they deployed and why you are not hearing the real reason. She's also following the story of what she has learned from visiting Gulf War inmates in prison for the crimes of homicide and dangers not being addressed appropriately by the Department of Defense. Including depleted uranium, and that brings us as a very interesting transition into next hour. And part of the awesomeness of this responsibility tonight will be to try to do justice to this book, The Last Train from Hiroshima. Charles Pellegrino is coming back. Love this man's work. Terrific researcher, wonderful writer. And he frames the story of what happened at Hiroshima in such a way that I'm afraid those of you who feel strongly about the appropriateness of using an atomic weapon like this might be challenged. Many people who wonder whether or not something like this could ever be survived in a limited tactical way, which as discussed before, will think twice about thinking about even using a tactical nuclear weapon. But most importantly, through his research, Charles Pellegrino is presenting us with information that has perhaps never been reported or never reported in this form. He's brought together eyewitness testimony and science in a new and, if you'll pardon the expression, exciting way. And I say exciting meaning it keeps taking your breath away to read this book, The Last Train from Hiroshima. It's heart-stopping. I mean, you come across things that you never knew, or at least I think most people never knew about Hiroshima, the bombing of Hiroshima in World War II. For example, are you aware that the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was a dud? I know that it just sounds preposterous to even suggest that that bomb that did that kind of devastation could be classified by anybody as a dud, but it is. And we'll tell you about that next hour. Be listening when we have Charles Pellegrino on talking about The Last Train from Hiroshima. What did The Last Train from Hiroshima actually mean? And where did it bring you? What happened? We'll tell you more about that, too, coming up on Coast to Coast. But first, Joyce Riley and a couple of crypto news points not to be missed in the blog tonight at coasttocoastam.com. Next, this is Ian Punnett. Well, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll find that we've got some great news stories up there, many of which will make fabulous nights of radio coming up in the months ahead, I'm sure. But one thing I wanted to thank you for, if you link onto coasttocoastam.com, go to my blog. You all did that so many times last week that this one of the featured links I had up there, the North American Bear Center, where Lily the mama bear is currently under the gaze of the bear cam, hibernating through sub-zero temperatures. So many people did that the North American Bear Center is benefiting greatly. Many contributions. These contributions make a big difference. Last week, thousands of dollars were raised. If you want to see the link, you can go to coasttocoastam.com, go to my blog, and it'll take you there to watch Lily the bear. Lily is hibernating, although you can watch her, you clearly watch her body heave, you know, as she deeply breathes and occasionally coos. You can hear the microphone is set up. And then you can hear her make these grunting noises toward her baby cub, which I've been told has made like a brief appearance on camera. Last time I checked, I was watching it earlier this evening, and there was about 600 people watching Lily the bear just breathe. But it's kind of cool. And we'll start to see the bear popping its nose up toward the camera in the weeks and months ahead. By the way, Lily isn't the only animal starring in her own reality show these days. I don't know if you've seen the BBC's been working on a project where chimps have been given cameras in order to shoot their own movies. And I put a link for that on the webpage, too. You can actually see it. With the possible exception of the movie Gigli, it's the first known film ever produced entirely by chimps. Gigli, I know there were many chimps involved, but not the entire production crew. Then again, too, maybe chimps were somehow involved in this whole NBC, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien disaster. I put up something on the blog. I've been thinking about this story a lot. I find it fascinating, actually, for reasons that have to do with both just how radio and television work and how we've all sort of experienced some version of this before, but also because I think there's a lot of hubris involved. And I wrote about that in the blog. You can go take a look online at coasttocoastam.com. And at the end of the blog, too, you'll see I put up a link for a story that appeared on a website earlier this week that shows what the map of the United States would look like if the borders of the states were reconfigured to provide for equal representation by each of the 50 states. So, for example, I'm leaving Alaska and Hawaii out of it. That if you lived in a state like California, California would be broken up into four different states. Some states would get super huge, other would get super small, but it would all be based on the idea that every state would have the same number of senators, which they're, you know, supposed to have two, but that they would also have the same number of congressional representatives, and that the senators, the representatives were representing the same amount of people. So you didn't have these densely populated states, say, on the east or the western coasts, that often feel underrepresented in the Senate. You know, why should a state with hardly anybody in it have the same votes as ones that have, you know, 100 times as many people in it? So anyway, the argument is made, this is not my argument, but the argument is made that in order to make it, quote unquote, fair, you have to redistribute the states. So if you go take a look on the blog, and if you don't want to read the rest of it, and it is a particularly long blog tonight, you can scroll down to the link and it'll show you where you might be living right now. What state would you be in? And the person who put it together actually went to the trouble of renaming all the states so that, you know, since it's a new world, everybody would have new states. But it's kind of an interesting idea anyway. You can take a look online at coasttocoastam.com. Now, I mentioned Charles Pellegrino coming up next hour. We'll be talking about the people that were affected by the last train from Hiroshima, also the people that suffered greatly under the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, and all of the most amazing things about the bomb and about what happened that day that you may never have heard. So Charles Pellegrino is coming on. He's going to talk about it. But I should also say, too, that if you want to get a copy of his book from Amazon, you better hurry. Because I learned tonight that his book was being banned by Amazon. Not for political reasons or social reasons or anything to do with censorship, except that Charles Pellegrino's publisher has decided to go with the format for this new iPad, right? The new Apple product where they're going to be downloading, you know, in from this new Apple bank of books, and Apple's going to be doing essentially what Amazon has been doing in with Kindle. And Amazon, according to what I've read tonight, is retaliating against any of the publishers that are signing on with Apple. Apparently, they're just going to refuse to sell any of the books by these organizations that dared to also do business with Apple. We'll talk about that when we talk with Charles Pellegrino coming up next hour. We'll find out more about that. But I know I've been online. I looked at Amazon's website. I think there are about 5 copies or something like that of Last Train from Hiroshima. But it's worth grabbing, and I hope you do. But more than that, it'll be amazing to hear it coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Nice to know that Joyce Riley is never forgotten. This conversation started last week when I was taking some open line calls. Good evening, Joyce.
Well, hello, Ian. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, it's been a while, and I'm glad to hear that that you're still on the case. That's just what we would hope from you. You are an RN, correct?
That's right.
Right. And you started following the story of Gulf War veterans who are suffering from this mysterious, well, a couple of different aspects of a mysterious syndrome, and you've been kind of one of the leading proponents of study and protection for the rights of these soldiers in wake of their service during the first Gulf War. And it was great. Somebody called and said, what's going on with her and how goes that these days? And so I have questions both about the first Gulf War and then also anything you're hearing about this Gulf War. But let's start back with the first Gulf War syndrome. And how are the men doing, this 15 years later, as it were?
Well, let me just remind you that back in 1991, during the time of the first Gulf War, there was about 700,000 troops that served in the Persian Gulf area. A lot of those were active duty, but we had Guard and Reserve also. But as a result of that, though, we only lost about 160 people during the war. The rest of, and that included the friendly fire casualties also.
Right.
However, it would shock everybody to know that since that Gulf War, and I'm glad you asked this question, during the past 12 years, nearly half of those 700,000 Gulf War veterans have had to seek treatment for a wide range of symptoms relating to the Gulf War illness. One half, even though we only had 160 killed, we've had 350,000 now that are attempting to get treatment.
Now, that seems just statistically, obviously anomalous. You would think, actuarially speaking, men that young wouldn't be seeking treatment that much. What are they seeking treatment for?
Well,
are there similarities?
A wide variety of things, from anything from major rashes that just won't heal, all the way up to neurological problems, cancers, brain tumors, a number of things related to depleted uranium. And about 29% of the soldiers have now been considered disabled that served in that war. That's one-third.
That's at least one-third.
But that doesn't really, it's not a real accurate figure because, unfortunately, they didn't follow the reservist and the guardsman, which I was a reservist at the time. So my illness was not included since I was, quote-unquote, just a reservist. So it's really an unfair statistic. Now, I did not deploy either. I served in a C-130 aircraft flying air evacuation missions from Alaska to Guantanamo, but I received the vaccines at the time. So one would think that the casualties might be included that also had some untoward effects from some of the vaccines that were given, but they're not really looking at that either. So I would really say, and this is just from what I talked to the Gulf War veterans from Gulf War One, about 80% of all of those troops are sick. They
right.
contact me, and when I talk to someone, it's about 8 out of 10 of all of the people are ill.
For the youngins out there, or for people who haven't dusted off those memories in a while, explain, if you would, Joyce Riley, the typical symptoms of Gulf War syndrome, what you were able to start putting together in terms of your research, and how the government eventually responded.
Okay, within about 6 months after I returned from my service, and remember, I did not deploy to the theater of operations, but I became ill. I had a neurological problem. I had trouble walking. I had a number of problems that I had never had before. And a lot of the people developed massive amounts of joint pain, headaches, blurred vision, any number of neurological or skin reactions to where they were. Depending on where they were is what their symptoms were involved with, but primarily headaches that went into other things after that. Some people had such horrible reactions on their skin, they actually did a skin transplant, a total 100% skin transplant on a troop.
Mm.
He died as a result of that.
Oh, gosh, I can't imagine.
It was horrible. It was just absolutely horrible. I happen to know that family, and it was a tragic, tragic situation. But then we began to see after that these bizarre illnesses that were neurological in origin, but really couldn't be identified because we'd never seen this kind of thing before. Because what you were seeing was a reaction of people, let's say the people that were in Kuwait and Iraq that had been near the chemical and biological detonations. They had the effects of chemicals, biologicals, depleted uranium from the munitions that were fired. There was also the problem with the immunizations that was quite serious.
Right.
And so all of these combined things, not to mention the Gulf War, the oil well fires. So all of these items together created this bizarre set of symptoms. And since the Department of Defense had never seen these before, or CDC or whomever, they simply said, oh, well, we can't identify it. It's a mystery illness. And you know how the government seems to like these mystery illnesses.
Right.
That
yeah,
they never have to find a cause for. And if you don't look for what the cause is, you'll never find it. And that's what happened with the Department of Defense. So for the first 10 years, they simply said, oh, it's got to be stress. That's it. You know, they wouldn't even consider anything else. And about 80 to 90% of all of those troops that ask for help were denied any kind of medical care. They were simply given Prozac, Zoloft, Wellbutrin,
right,
number of SSRI right, or antipsychotic drugs.
Right, which if you're not psychotic and you are not, you know, suffering from depression, even for people that are, and we talked about this last week in a different show, but can you imagine giving somebody who's not depressed and somebody who's not psychotic massive amounts of SSRIs that's going to create a problem?
Oh, yeah, they're going to be depressed yeah, after that, yes. Well, and a lot of these people said, look, I'm not depressed. I'm sick, and I need help. We had something called exploding heart syndrome, in which the heart just got so large that it eventually just basically ruptured and exploded. And I was called one time by Brook Army Medical Center and told that they had another patient in the ER at that time with exploding heart syndrome. It got to be quite common in the military. But the thing is, Ian, you're not hearing about these things. You're not hearing about it. And the reason is that if people knew how seriously ill the first Gulf War I veterans were, no one would join the military. Mm-hmm. What happened was the tragedy of all tragedies is that we basically set up our troops knowing full well that when they went into Iraq, they were going to get hit with chemicals and biologicals. And yes, they were used in the first Gulf War, though our government doesn't want to admit to that because in the 1980s, Donald Rumsfeld made a deal with Saddam Hussein in 1983 that all of a sudden they were no longer a terrorist government. They were a good country, and we could do business with them, and we were going to sell them. To start off with, let's just try chemicals and biologicals.
Yeah, right, which is always, that's one of those forgotten pages of history that I think many people in the last even 15 years worth of administrations would much rather forget, that at one point they were actually feeding the beast that they would later go on to have to fight.
Bingo. Yeah. Well, I've even had them deny it in a letter from the
Department. Oh, really?
Yes. In fact, we had someone who was on a very high-level judge who reminded them of some certain documentation, and they changed their statement. However, Donald Rumsfeld, and I do want to bring this up because he was listed as an envoy for the Reagan administration when he met to meet with Saddam Hussein. Well, what they didn't tell you is he was president and CEO of G.D. Searle Pharmaceutical Company.
Sure.
And he was setting up the arrangements, essentially, for these chemicals, biologicals, et cetera. So we began selling them to Iraq up until 1999 when a company in Maryland was selling them anthrax, which is people find very hard to believe. But if you will go to Senate Report 103-900, it lists the batch numbers, the dates, that it was all transferred to Iraq.
I think most people actually probably listen to the show probably would accept that. But that at one point we had done that exact same thing. Well, let's put that on hold for the moment and come back to the big question, too, of how have they responded to this information? And then we got to know how are the new troops being affected? What are you hearing about this current wave of returning Gulf War veterans from Gulf War II? And then we got to know more about the sad stories about the number of homicides we're hearing about, too, and how this could all be related. Joyce Riley's research continues. I've heard that Charles Pellegrino is looking forward to talking about the blacklist tonight, Amazon blacklisting the book, Last Train from Hiroshima, We'll tell you more about that coming up at the top of the hour. He's hopping mad. I don't blame him. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Joyce Riley, we'll take some of your calls here coming up in just a minute, but we still have a little ground to cover before we can get to your contribution. And then we changed the link at coasttocoastam.com for The Last Train from Hiroshima, Charles Pellegrino's book. We've changed it to barnesandnoble.com so that you will have ample access to this book tonight. And I think you're going to want to order it. It's just that good. You just won't be able to do that through Amazon. Amazon has just announced that it's blacklisting all of the books from Macmillan Books because of this fight with the Apple's iPad. And Charles Pellegrino's book is caught in the crossfire on this. But you'll hear the amazing story of how the bomb that exploded over Hiroshima was actually a dud. More on that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. But first, back to the Gulf War syndrome, both for Gulf War I and Gulf War II. What's happening with these soldiers and what can we do to help take care of them next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. All right, so Joyce Riley, hanging on here for a couple of callers we promised to get to before the top of the hour, but I had to interrupt you as we got to the bottom of the hour about how things were happening and that you were at one point, you were the one that was helping to sort of collate all this information together so that everybody knew that there was a variety of things that have been happening to Gulf War veterans from the first Gulf War, underreported. We all know that the mainstream media has severe ADD, so they never focus on things like they don't follow up as well as they should on stories like this. But how did the government do? Eventually, you know, weren't there were congressional hearings and so where does it stand right now for Gulf War veterans? Are they getting the care they need from the government for the first Gulf War?
Well, the answer to that is absolutely not. The Department of Defense has done everything they can to try and keep the people from learning the severity of the illness of the Gulf War I veterans for a lot of reasons. They've hid behind something called the Farah's Doctrine, which is a case adopted in the doctrine adopted in the 1950s that basically says we can do anything we want to you and you have no right to sue us and no standing to sue us. So there's been no real help for the Gulf War veterans.
Let me jump in. Why don't they just say, you can't sue us, but here's what happened. Why don't they just say, you can't sue us because, you know, the law prevents you from doing that, but here's what we did to you.
Well, because I think that it would be so heinous, there'd be people out for blood. Because what they did was they sent people over in defective mop gear. It turned out later that they found out and knew early on that the mop gear was ineffective, had holes in it. And you can't have a hole in a gas mask or or in a suit, but they did. No. What happened was the Department of Defense had to hide this for so long and keep it away from the knowledge of the people. I mean, these people would be out for blood if the parents knew that their children had been sent into harm's way by design. And it was done that way. We sent them in where there was mustard gas, sarin gas, that we provided to Iraq, and they knew full well that was going to happen. So the DOD started this, it's got to be stress, it's got to be stress. It's all in your head. So we sent over a bunch of troops over there, 700,000 troops, that they ruled to be about 70% of those that ask for help to be mental cases. Well, they don't come back mental cases. They come back sick, and they are identified as mental cases because then the Department of Defense can kind of wash their hands of them.
If you're sick, it must be in your head. You're the problem. Nothing external to you is the problem.
Bingo. And that was set up in the first Gulf War, or the precedent was set, if you will.
Right.
Just put them on SSRI drugs, antidepressants, and get them out of the military as fast as you can. Well, then we have the advent of Gulf War II.
Right.
And Gulf War II is in spades worse than Gulf War One.
Really? I tell you what, that because they don't see the burning oil fields that they would have seen from Gulf War one, and I didn't know I haven't been told of any biological weapons that was used on troops in Gulf War II. How could it be worse?
Because it's the radiation exposures that they're getting. Okay. The depleted uranium, which is just a misnomer, that's to make everybody feel warm and fuzzy that it's okay to use it. But uranium, this depleted uranium that they call it, is a byproduct of the nuclear weapons industry. They didn't know how to get rid of it, so they basically sold it to the military, and they're using it. And the military loves it because it's very dense, and it'll go through a tank like butter. So you put it inside whatever shell you're using. It's basically in almost all the munitions that are used now. And then when it hits its target, it is so hard and so dense, it'll go like right through the Iraqi tanks, which is, it works well. And the purpose of war is to kill people and break things. So
right.
That's what they do. Well, this depleted uranium, though, has a uranium dust because it catches on fire. Pyrophoric, and when it catches on fire, then it turns into this uranium dust. This uranium dust has a half-life of like 3.4 billion years. So you've got something now that's never going to dissipate. Then what happens is that it is either breathed in, or it is eaten in food, or drunk in water by our troops, and then that causes the uranium dust to lodge somewhere in the body. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say just one particle of depleted uranium lodges in the lungs of someone, just one particle. What happens is that will give that person, and it can be a particle 5 micrometers, like the size of a virus.
Right.
That will expose them over a year up to 272 times the safe amount of body radiation that's allowed for workers in this country. So they're having millions of these particles inside their bodies. One physician, one doctor, Dr. Durakovic, told me that that's equal to them getting a chest x-ray about every 5 minutes for the rest of their life.
Oh, my God. I can't imagine. But well, how does that turning into, and because I'm trying to be mindful of our time, how is that affecting, is that what's causing more Gulf War veterans or, as I understand it, visiting Gulf War inmates to be charged with homicide? Is there a correlation to behavior and this radiation exposure?
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about it, because when I visit them inside the prisons, what I'm hearing is that there's something very strange going on. I mean, it's very bizarre. It could be in combination with the drugs that they're on or whatever, but these people are starting to hear voices in their heads.
Uh-oh.
That says to kill someone. Now, it's the story that when I talk to them, and this has never been told on the air before. Most people have never, ever heard this, so it's not like it's passing from, you know, defendant to defendant and used in their defense. It's something I'm hearing from them. They are unable to keep from killing someone, and they usually kill the person they love the most. Now, I know this is going to upset a lot of veterans, and I need to tell you something, that there is a warning here for family members, because a lot of these troops have killed, there's about 120 homicides with the second Gulf War veterans already. The 120 of the returning Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom have committed 120 homicides. Now, that's just in the Gulf War II troops. We know it's huge in the Gulf War I also. Now, I've not been visiting the Gulf War II troops, but I'm hearing the same stories from their families. And the scary part is that whatever neurological problem is happening, because the depleted uranium does lodge in the brain and cause these neurological problems, is that something is happening in their thinking. And even though, as in the one case I visited this man in prison, he had never even really had an argument with his wife. They loved each other. Everybody thought they did. And what he did to his wife, he can't even talk about it now because he doesn't still really believe that he did it. But in the three cases that I've been strongly involved with their attorneys, they all did the same thing. They committed the murder. Then they called 911 and said, everybody here is dead, and I'm the only one that's not. Could I have done this?
Now, were they on SSRIs when they did this? I mean, I know that the government, you said, had been handing these out like Pez. I'm just curious because I know that we've also heard that from people who have gone through a disassociative experience on antidepressants, and they can't quite tell what's real and what's not real.
That's exactly right. They are like in a daydream. They think they are in a dream and they're doing something in a dream. They don't like doing it, but they did it anyway. Well, the majority of the people that I talked to were on SSRIs. Now, that some were not, though, which makes us wonder what is involved here. But it's because, and the reason I'm telling you this is because I'm so concerned about their stories being so similar.
Department
of Defense, as of this point, is playing this game of, they're committing suicide. I mean, the suicide rate is huge. I mean, 160 troops committed suicide last year. Now, that, believe me, that figure should be a lot higher than that. But those are the ones that DOD is saying, we'll give our, approval that was a suicide. But I think there are a lot more than that. However, when you consider the amount of homicides and suicides that are taking place in these bizarre scenarios to which there is no motive, then you have to start saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? And to answer that, I don't know. That's why I'm filming them, getting the permission from their attorneys to film their situations. We've already had one troop that has been put to death at Terre Haute, Indiana, who I personally happen to believe, was very much affected by this. He had 3 bronze stars, he had 6 medals, and 3 of them were bronze stars from the Gulf War. And they fast-tracked his execution. And I tried to talk with the attorney and work with him, but I kind of got the feeling that perhaps the DOD was involved with the attorney also. And they fast-tracked it.
It's hard to imagine. I want to get to as many calls as I can. Again, we're talking with Joyce Riley, and that you can link up to her through our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. So if you're only hearing some of the story and you need to know more, you can get to her website from there. Let's go west of the Rockies. Douglas is in San Francisco for Joyce Riley. Go ahead, Douglas.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mr. Punnett, and thanks for what you're doing for the veterans community by having Nurse Riley with us. Nurse Riley, I want you to know there's no way I can thank you enough for everything you've done for years. I was a veteran of what Americans call Gulf War I, though properly it was actually Gulf War II because the first Gulf War was Iran-Iraq. And I was with Task Force Taro of the United States Marine Corps. We got further in country into Iraq itself than any other unit. So we were south of Kamisaya when the engineers blew the bunkers that were loaded with sarin and cyclosarin nerve gas. And we all had to take our mop gear hoods off. If you ever see that photo on Life magazine that got real famous, those little Technicolor mushroom clouds where all those Marines are standing and looking at the bunkers being blown, they all have their hoods off because every single one of us was losing 17 pounds of water weight in as many minutes because that mop gear was lined with charcoal. So we had a choice of either dying of dehydration or taking the hoods off and risking what we're going to suck into our lungs. After that war was over, my lungs collapsed 7 times. They finally had to staple my lungs to my rib cage to keep them from collapsing again. This was all done by civilians because by spontaneous pneumothoraxes, my lung collapses were not recognized by the Department of Defense, so I had to pay $72,000 out of my own pocket for that.
Wow.
Now, Dr. Durakovich, the reason that he worked for the VA and analyzed the chromosomal damage on the Gulf War vets that proved that they were all exposed to more radiation than anybody who had undergone chemotherapy all of their adult lives, he paid out of pocket for that test because he's Serbian. He's half Serb, and he was concerned about the use of depleted uranium by NATO in Serbia. And ultimately, he was fired from the VA. But what we all have to recognize is that there's 2 factors here. One is that the Gulf War II, Gulf War I, whatever you call it, properly right now what's going on is Gulf War III. This is a nuclear war. And in this nuclear war, the population fights harder than ever against the occupation force because they have nothing to lose. And
all right, Douglas, let's give Joyce Riley a chance to respond before we run out of time. Go ahead, Joyce.
Number one, I'd like to talk with him at a later date. I wish he'd contact me through my website because he's right about everything he's saying. My goodness, look what this man has been through. Now,
right.
This is the silent suffering that these people are having to do at their own expense. You don't see any DOD listing him as a casualty to that war. And this is incredibly, this is the biggest story in America today, is we're killing our own people. They're being kicked to the side of the curb, waiting for an army to die to get rid of the evidence of these people. Let me just say, in response to Dr. Durakovich, he began testing for depleted uranium in this country after the VA fired him when he spoke out. When he began testing for this, all of a sudden, the Department of Defense bought up every laboratory facility that tested for depleted uranium. We cannot even get it tested in this country right now. It costs about $2,500 to send a sample to Germany to get it tested. Now, this is what the DOD is doing to hide the deaths of our people as a result of their service in the military. And I have to tell you, on Memorial Day and Veterans Day, that is the two saddest days of my year, because I watch all the pomp and circumstance on television. Meanwhile, our troops are slowly dying. They're dying a horrible, very painful death. And I thank you very much for calling in and confirming what I'm saying. I wish it wasn't true. This is a huge story, Ian.
I know that, and that's one of the reasons why we're glad to have you back. And thank you for getting that information out there. Bill is in South Carolina, east of the Rockies, for Joyce Riley on Coast to Coast. Bill?
Hi, yes. My question is, my comments mainly are for Joyce.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of course.
I was in the first Gulf War. I went over on the advanced party with 24th Infantry Division, which has been deactivated and replaced by the 3rd Infantry Division at Fort Stewart. And I retired after a little over 20 years in 91 after the war. And after I got back, I noticed I had a lot of problems. After a month or so, I reported to my doctor I felt like I had the flu.
Right.
And there was basically no action taken. It was just treated like I had the flu. And I noticed I was cranky and didn't pay attention to anything anymore. I just let bills pile up. I'd stare at them every day. Plenty of time to take care of them. I wouldn't take care of them. Finally, in 94, my wife got sick of me, and we got divorced.
Well, Bill, you got to help us, because I want to get to the bottom line as quickly as I can here in terms of time. But what did you determine was happening to you, and how can Joyce Riley help?
Well, we were actually, we went through Camisea and north of it. We were at the point of the quarterback sneak, or whatever they like to call it, in the 24th, and actually went north of Kuwait about halfway across the country when the war ended.
You know, let me just add something. I'm sorry to interrupt here, but I think, you know, this is the kind of person that I need to talk to. I will send you at no charge to any person who's been in the military a copy of Beyond Treason. It explains all of this information, so we don't have to do it one at a time. But it's a documentary called Beyond Treason. I will send it to you at no charge if you would just email me at the website that's up on the page there. It's about an hour and 45 minutes to explain all this to the veterans, Ian.
I think it's important, and Bill, we'll make sure we'll get you that information, and thank you for sharing your story. Everybody can reach out to Joyce Riley through her webpage. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. Have time left, I think, for one last caller, Jerry in Santa Monica. Jerry?
Thank you so much, Ian and Joyce, for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment that I'm relatively sure that a lot of the illnesses and injuries are also coming down to the inoculations that are given to the veterans. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and we were hit with Agent Orange real quick. And I'll just give Joyce a real quick stat and yourself, Ian. Out of the 2.7 million, including myself, that were rotated in the country, RAND Corporation from Santa Monica alone shows 92,000 suicides as of a report I obtained approximately 4.5 years ago. In addition to that, also out of the 2.7 rotated in, there are only 92,000 left. A lot of the vets are dying from Agent Orange between 52 and 62. I'm 61, and I believe largely caused by possible inoculations in Agent Orange. And I can give now my information to your screener for the book. And thank you so much for your time. And
you.
I don't know if the doctor has time for a comment.
I'll put you on hold here, and that will probably have to wait till a further conversation between you both. But thank you, Jerry, for that. And thank you, Joyce.
Thank you,
and
Ian.
And that depleted uranium story, that's big. Don't give up on getting that news out there. We'll do our best to remind people about that, too.
Thank you.
So thank you. And we look forward to having you back on again sometime soon. Well, obviously, if depleted uranium is so dangerous, what about undepleted uranium? The last train from Hiroshima coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet.